Welcome to the Dork Forest. Jackie and her pals will never bore us. Shameless confessions
about our obsessions
will make us laugh and smile. So let's explore the Dork Forest and dork out for a while.
Hi, Rangers of the Dork Forest. It's me, Jackie Cation, and you are listening to the Dork Forest. You can go to the websites, JackieCation.com and DorkForest.com. JackieCation.com has DorkForest.com. It has the audio links. It has the video links to my YouTube. It has all of my dates for stand-up comedy. It has all the merch. It's got Dork Forest merch and stand-up merch and all of my CDs and DVDs if you have those devices. Other things you can do, Bandcamp. There's a Bandcamp with the very old episodes. Some of them are free. And then there's a storytelling album that you can get on my Bandcamp. And I'm on Pandora and Spotify. It is 2025, and feel free to start donating to the Dork Forest. Yeah, cost me about 10 grand a year to put this up. If everybody donated $100 every year, if everybody just handed me $100 every time they saw me, or PayPal, Venmo, then I would have, I think, about 10 grand. I don't know, but I would have enough money to run this and probably buy myself lunch. And I'm a big fan of doing the show. I'll do it anyway. But if you have $100, send me $100. If you have $2, send me $2. You can do it monthly on PayPal. There's buttons all over my website. And my Venmo is just my name. No hyphen, Jackie Cation. I'm wearing a red shirt. Let's get into the show. Oh my gosh, it's me, Jackie Cation, shouting into the internet. I do have AirPods in. Patrick, I hope this sounds good, is what I have to say to that. And of course, Rangers, I hope it sounds extraordinary for you. I am in a hotel in our nation's capital before it all goes to hell. And speaking with me here in the Dork Forest, returning guest, but from several years ago, Alice Fraser. From Australia. Welcome back to the program, Alice Fraser.
It is a delight to be back here. I'm very happy. I feel like I'm a whole new person. I've had two whole new people in the meantime, so you know.
Oh my gosh. Have you replicated yourself twice?
Yes, since we last spoke. Yes.
Oh my gosh. Wow, congratulations on some real genetic That's a real alpha lady thing to do. Did you have one of each? Did you have two of the one kind at this point?
I had one of each, which was, you know, complete. Task complete.
Exactly. Who knows what they'll be like 15 years from now. But as of now, they're one of each. So good for them. Alice Fraser, by the way, it's F-R-A-S-E-R. And so it's alicefraser.com. And you have a Patreon/AliceFraser. And it's at alliterative, A-L-I-T-E-R-A-T-I-V-E, on the socials, right? On like Instagram and such?
Yes, on the socials. Well, on the Instagram and then Blue Sky, I think I'm just Alice Fraser, yeah.
Oh, there you go. And then I'm catching up. It's late for you. It's early for me. Did you just write a book called A Passion for Passion?
Yes. Well, this is the thing about books. I didn't know. They said, do you want to write a book? I wrote a book. I gave it to them. I wrote it. I finished it in September 2023. And I was like, okay. I assume it will come out in a few weeks. And it is.
I don't think that's how it does. But how could you know? You can't know until you do it.
No. And it was sort of, now it's coming out on the 5th of February this year. Which is great, but I just didn't know that it took that long. And they do tell you that it takes that long, but only when you ask them why it takes that long. And then they don't tell you why it takes that long. They just sort of, they're like, oh, schedules, and you have to book it in with the print and the publication. And they just say sort of words, but they don't actually, the words don't explain the thing that you're asking them to explain to you.
Right, because it's not like they're placing all the letters like it's the Gutenberg Bible and it's 1577. It is genuinely, they should just be able to put it into a machine.
Yeah.
And then they bind it. I worked at Kinko's, which is now called FedEx Office, and we used to print all kinds of things in days.
That's what I thought. And then, but they're like, oh, publication schedules and like bookshop, how do we shelve it and stuff like that. I think it comes out in the US on the 5th of May, by the way, or March or May. I always get those two confused. But the point is that why does it take that long? I genuinely, in this conversation, ask the questions, is it like a low-cost airline? Like, do you have to just wait for a slot to come over? Like, I don't know what's happening. Is the book taxiing? Is it like circling around waiting to land?
Is there some sort of, is there an opening it's looking for? I wonder.
So it's not taxiing. Taxiing is not when they're in the air. That's Ubering. It's the opposite of taxiing when they're in the air.
But I knew what you meant, because it does feel like they are waiting for some sort of window.
Yeah.
To sort of open up so that they can do it all at once. And you're like, okay. But whatever it is, it's either coming out in February if you're in Australia, or May if you're here. And it's called A Passion for Passion. And it's about romance novels?
It is. It's an extremely silly book about romance novels. It is it's a sort of jokes and essays and bits and pieces and an argument. It, like, underlying it all is this argument about joy and why we should be allowed to like things that are silly.
And, there you go. Which is The Dork Forest in a freaking nutshell, because people are like, well, I would love to come on The Dork Forest, but, you know, it's just kind of silly. You know, I really like RuPaul. And I'm like, did you miss the title of the program? It's called The Dork Forest. Tell me what you love, right? And last night, I couldn't get to sleep for some reason. I think I was worried about making sure that I got up for this. So I re-listened to, and then, of course, I stayed up listening to it, because what I do with books is I read them in probably paperback form, because I'm whatever it is. I like to carry a paperback, and then I like to read it on a Kindle. I like to get it again for a reread so I can have it anytime I'd like. And then I also enjoy having it on Audible or Libby or some sort of library app where it is read to me like I am a child. And so it is a delight. And so last night I listened to Anne McCaffrey's Dragon Riders of Pern.
Oh, the Dragon Riders of Pern.
And it was the Harper, the first of the Harper trilogies. So it was essentially the teenage one that she wrote in the '70s.
Yes.
And it was about Manali. Well, whatever.
Melody, but yeah, I know the one you mean.
Right. It's about the kid who writes music, and
Yes.
And I've read it so many times that I can't remember.
I got a badge at my high school as the roving library monitor, because I used to go into the library during lunchtime and read books because I was too bullied to be allowed onto the playground. And most of what I was reading I was sort of embarrassed to get this badge, which was like, oh, you're a serious person who comes in here and read, because most of what I was reading was borderline dragon pornography.
Well, and the thing is I remember being mocked as a kid when I read, and they were all like, you're so smart. And I'm like, you have absolutely no idea what I'm reading. It's not that smart. This is available for anybody. I was reading boys' books about the Civil War and I was like, I was getting some history.
Yep.
But the research that's done in a lot of genres books can be amazing, can also be pretty loosey goosey. And
yes.
So
yes.
It was Dragon Song, by the way.
Dragon Song. Yes. There were the Dragon books, the Dragon Riders of Pern, and they sort of veer along this like really interesting spectrum between very, very dragon-y sort of medieval Pern, and then the sci-fi stuff, and then there was The Ship Who Sang, which was all about sexy ship
people,
brains that were being put into ships, and like it's stuff that like probably doesn't hold up to today's political stuff, but Or scientifically, or like, yeah, there was some like questionable stuff there, but like that was part of the, you know, it was simpler times.
I will say this about Anne McCaffrey, is she was writing in a very male dominated, like, you know, when you write to, and I do it in stand up, and I don't know, but you write to sort of pander to the men in the audience. And
yes,
I think she was trying to get published, and also because her women characters were very strong, but they were also, they had like this sort of caricature of nurturing. And there are, you know, there are stereotypes that we were, whether it's nature or nurture, for women to be all this, you know, this caring, you know, this kind of thing. I know, because I was having a conversation. This is my dorkdom. Thank you for calling in and listening to me talk, Alice Fraser.
I'm so fucking delighted by this. I don't care where we go from here.
Oh, good. All right. So Andy and I were having a conversation about there are DC movies. There's the Suicide Squad movie, the Birds of Prey movie, and Suicide Squad 2. And Suicide Squad 2 is directed by James Gunn and was, I believe, written by him as well. And he has done all of the Guardians of the Galaxy in Marvel Universe. And he is an 11-year-old boy, right? Mm-hmm. He is very funny and very smart, but he is also, he's like, he's an idiot, right? Yeah. And so he enjoys, I don't know, just like holding his dick in his hand and jumping up and down. I mean, these types of things, which, so if you look at Suicide One, which was not done by him, but was just done by some, I don't know who it was, but it was an attempt at comedy and dark, dark DC murder comedy, essentially, right?
Yes. Was that the one where the whole first half was just like slow-mo action shots of like, this is the guy. And then it was like, now this is the other guy.
That was Suicide 2, I think, which was better than Suicide 1. And because it was very silly and very fun. But Birds of Prey is the Margot Robbie, Harley Quinn, DC one. And it is also a lot of, this is me, the lady, and here's me blowing things up, and I'm sad because the Joker doesn't like me anymore, and I'm never going to eat this sandwich. I mean, very absurdist and very silly. But it has, I would say, I guess, a stereotypical or possibly, and I don't know if it's nature or nurture, but it has a more feminine edge to it that gives it a little more empathy and gives it a little more roundness to it which makes me like it more, just because as much as I enjoy James Gunn, and I do, I wish he had had Margot Robbie or a woman, just another person with a little more empathy going, I don't know, put a puppy in there or something.
Yeah. Yes. So this is like one of the things that I've been thinking, obviously, with the romance novels and the crisis of masculinity and as you say, this like nurturing thing that is characterized as female. And I feel like we have lost touch with the fact that masculinity at its best is also nurturing and meant to be nurturing. How did we, like, of course, first of all, we're people, the way we survive is by looking after each other. That's the evolutionary advantage we have, right?
Right.
How has that been outsourced to women? Actually, it is the job of everyone. Like, men look after people and women look after people and we all look after people. And you now, for some reason, it's only acceptable to be nurturing as a man if you're a sports coach.
Right, you know, like, right. If you're a coach, then you're that guy. You're the guy that looks after the team and looks after the boys and it looks after,
And so and so this is one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot, is that like romance novels, for example, are not sillier than James Bond.
No, they are exactly as dumb.
They're exactly as dumb. It's exactly as dumb to think that, you know, a cowboy with 8 abs is going to come and help you fix your small business and give you orgasms as it is to think that you can clip someone at the back of the ear and have them be full unconscious for a convenient 20 minutes and wake up with no other harm done. Like,
right. And the guy who killed your dog is going to be avenged. You know, yes. I mean, the guy who killed, I mean, if you love John Wick, and we all do, that guy avenges his dog. And it's because he loved his wife, but it's because his dog was killed that he goes through a killing spree for 6 movies, which is ridiculous, right?
Yeah. Yes, Your Honor. Yes, I did murder upwards of 25 people. To be fair, they killed the dog that reminded me of my wife. Like that's.
Exactly. I don't think you understand. Yeah. No, we do. We do. We get it. And yeah, so they're
not. And that,
not,
and that okay,
no
sorry,
realism.
Just as a side note, that is because in movies, the death of a dog is more emotionally potent than the death of a wife.
It's true. You can avenge your wife, but you can only avenge in sort of it's a finite amount of revenge. Yep. A dog, there's no bottom to that vengeance.
There's no bottom because they've devalued the wife currency. Wives get murdered dime a dozen. You've like, that's inflation out the wazoo. You've got to kill like 100 wives to get one dog is like.
Right.
Yeah, right. It's the,
but a year old dog, that's irreplaceable. Wives, yeah. You can get yourself another one. yeah, but it is interesting. Just the sort of the. Yeah, the it is more respect ever since Bridgerton, I would say, that they are trying to do what they did to science fiction, which is they're trying to make it literature. They're trying to justify it. This is what they did in the mid to late 80s.
Yeah.
Because I took a class, the first of its kind, in 1985 or 84, and it was a Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, and Charles Williams, an Inklings class. And it was The Lord of the Rings,
amazing.
The space trilogy of C.S. Lewis, and 2 books by Charles Williams. He was their third Inkling. Nobody remembers him. He was actually an excellent writer and just as spooky. But but prior to that, they weren't, it wasn't considered literature, right? I mean, to consider Anne McCaffrey literature, to consider, Robert Heinlein became literature before Anne McCaffrey, right? William Gibson definitely became literature before either of them because he
William
was
Gibson's
science.
Neuromancer was one of the only 2 readable books in my dad's shelves. Because my dad ran a not-for-profit copyright thing. And so when I would stay in his office after school waiting for him to finish work, he had these bookshelves full of like legal texts.
Right.
And then 2 books. One was William Gibson's Neuromancer because it had the first use of the word internet on it.
Something like that, right.
And then the other one was the story of St. Columbus, the saint who had the first copyright case in history where he snuck into a church and copied their Bible without their permission, actually against their say-so,
copied all
the beautiful pictures. And then he was sort of cousins with the king, and then the king said, you know, to every book, to every cow belongs its calf, so to every book belongs its copy. I must have read those 2 books 1,000 times. Yeah, exactly.
Wow. What was that? Say that again. Tell me again the book that invented copyright.
Saint Columbus. Yeah, Saint Columbus in his case against King Dara, I think.
Wow.
One of the Irish kings. Not the Bog Kings, but the other Irish king.
All right. And what I like about that is that I was supposed to know that there were Bog Kings, and I will. Now I will.
They found them in the they found those kings in the bogs, and they had their nipples cut off because they weren't breast. This brings me back to nurturing masculinity. They weren't sufficiently looking after their people, and so they cut off their boobs to represent the fact that they weren't feeding their people. And these weren't
excellent.
And then they tucked them in the bog. If you were not looking after your people sufficiently well. You know, divine mandate and all of that. And if the crops failed, chuck him in a bog, cut his nipples off.
I went to a museum in Ireland and saw one of those guys. I mean, you would think that they would just leave them. I wonder about about the history of digging up, you know, the pharaohs and obviously the Nipolis, kings of the bogs. But now I do remember that.
When I die, jump the queue, put me straight in a museum, just with a question mark.
Just a giant. What did she do wrong? What did she do right? But I will say there's a new way of publishing here in the United States of romance novels, which are no longer the small mass paperbacks.
Mm-hmm.
They're putting them in the larger trade paperbacks in an effort, I think, to gentrify or to legitimize these books. And they've changed the covers of the books, so it's no longer traditional bodice ripper, where it's not just some dude in a puffy shirt showing his, you know, just essentially in between his sternum, in between his pecs, and then she's wearing a fancy ball gown. And I'm like, hey, I would like to judge my books by its cover, and now I cannot.
I don't know what level of Fabio is on the front cover. You know, and they're giving them like whimsical, fun names like the lust conundrum or something, the cheeky banter, rather than like Greek billionaires returned baby heiress on Dolphin Island. Which, you know, like, you know what you're getting.
You know exactly. Oh my God, I remember when I first started reading romance novels in junior high. Everybody, and this is back in the 12th century. So remember. All the guys were millionaires, and now they're all billionaires because it just isn't enough. It isn't enough. And it's fantasy. So you're like, no. Larry down at the pub, he's a millionaire. I don't need to hang out with Larry. Let's find, you know, Kostaki Economopoulos, which is a comic. You don't want to. I mean, he's fine, too. He's perfectly handsome Greek guy, but I was just picking a Greek name. But it's always a Greek billionaire that I went to Australia at least 5 or 6 times a year in Harlequin romances as a child. There was always some outback dude with a lariat. And he was like, there's water problems. And
I mean, that does sound like us. Yeah, that's very us.
And then he was super handsome and she was from the big city, and it was pre-Hallmark movies, so he didn't have a Christmas tree factory. He had a giant cattle ranch.
Oh my goodness. That was, I mean, you read those books. Guess who else read those books? The entire second wave of female immigration to Australia, because First Fleet criminals, majority men, not that many women, they were treated very badly. Second Fleet, the women formed cartels and started brothels. And then they basically built all of the Rocks area of Sydney. That kind of historical area was built on brothel money. All the money, all the power, all of the information was running through these brothels. And the guys back in England panicked. They call them these damned whores. We need to solve this problem. And there's a great book by Anne Somers called Damned Whores and God's Police. So they got people to write romance novels aimed at genteel young women in order to get them to go over to Australia and gentrify the womanhood there.
Right, willing to marry all of the guys who had survived being shipped there stacked like cordwood
the whores didn't have the monopoly on pussy. Like, that was it. Like, it was a very calculated, and it worked. Like, don't get me wrong. Yeah. It was a very, but they did that by writing romance novels where women would go over and find like handsome ranches, and you ended up with these women out in the middle of fucking nowhere, like 100 kilometers from the nearest toilet seat. Like,
what year is this? What decade was the second wave? So, would that have been 1800s or would that have been?
Yeah, 1800s. So 1788 was when the first fleet came. So it was sort of like early-ish 1800s, first couple of decades of the 1800s.
Interesting. I am now fascinated to find these weird romance novels. Because I've never heard of those historical romance novels where they're just like, I mean, essentially Harlequin romances. So set in where they're just like, it's going to be exciting. What you'll do is you'll go to Australia and then you'll go to the middle of Adelaide where it doesn't exist right now. But you will build a city.
Yeah, exactly. You will fight a snake with a shovel. You will be a drover's wife. You will never talk to another human being in your life. And you will build Australia. These incredibly tough women who are, just got tricked into...
into coming and building a nation and taking away the being party to taking away the land from the people who were living perfectly fine on it and knew that they didn't want to build cities. It's not going to work. The natives were like, the aboriginals were like, seriously,
it's fine.
But you're going to want to do, you're going to want to keep moving because that snake will kill you. So.
Yes, everything wants to eat you here. But yeah, no, like but to return to science fiction and the, like, I feel like Heinlein, wonderful, great, good ideas. Sure. Lois McMaster Bujold, way better because you actually give a shit about the characters.
Yes. Lois McMaster Bujold is one of my very favorites. You know, I got to talk to her in the Dork Forest once, and I got to talk to Cage Baker, who does more science-y science fiction. Have you read the Cage Bakers? I talk about Cage Baker every 6 to 9 months. And
My daughter is named after a Lois McMaster Bujold character. So
which one?
I can't cut that out.
No worries.
It's not on the internet. But yes.
Okay, yeah.
So half King Lear, half Cordelia Naismith. Because she was the first sensible female character that I'd ever fucking read in one of these sci-fi novels who wasn't like trying to kick someone's ear through their head and or just be booby and amazing.
When we were driving up to visit Andy's mom during lockdown, I just started putting the Lois McMaster Bujold books, the listenable ones on Audible, and Andy completely got into him, and he was like, because as great as Miles Vorkosigan is, and the two books before that, and granted, I have not read as much of Lois McMaster Bujold's fantasy stuff. Have you? I read The Sharing Knife. That was the only one.
The Sharing Knife, The Spirit Ring.
The Spirit Ring.
Yeah, they're fun. They're fun.
Oh, good.
But I think the Shards of Honor and Barrier are just
head
and shoulders.
Yeah, and there's a reason she won Hugo's for it every time because that was back in the day when if there was a little bit of sexy times or a little bit of romance, you could win the Hugo, and that's why Heinlein won a couple of them because he loved a group sexy time. He was like, polygamy.
But they were never, I mean, group sexy times people, let's be honest. Do you know many group sexy times people?
I've met them.
They love a spreadsheet. They are not exciting people. They are just sex nerds. I love them dearly.
Yes. But it's a little pedantic. It's just a little, it's
very
nerdy.
Rules-based.
Yes,
they get off more on the chat beforehand about like who's allergic to what kind of lube.
Yes, as exciting your thruple as fun as that is, you just love the logistics more than anything else.
Yeah, I'm just not enough of a planner for this shit. Like I just
exactly. And then, I mean, I suppose that's why like people who just cheat. They're like, they're just more spontaneous, I guess. They just want to just get laid.
They're just not good at admin. Yeah.
Yes. They just need some sort of personal appearance agent. If I could somehow schedule this for
I need a manager. I need a polyamory manager. I'm sorry. Yes.
And then everyone would
tell me where I'm going and who I'm fucking.
And when I'm going. And I have been in
ideally when I'm coming as well. I've got a schedule.
Uh-huh. TikTok. I've been in one threesome and it was dumb. It was fine. Everybody, nobody came. I don't think anybody came. And we were just essentially naked and drunk. And there was a lot of a lot of open hand touching too. So I was just like, I don't really understand. I mean, granted, I'm not saying we did it right. I'm sure that there was a better, there's a better way. With a schedule, with some sort of instructional manual, we could have done this more like, maybe that's why Twister was invented. So it was just, yeah.
And this is why masculinity, you need a coach on the sidelines who's nurturing.
Just like, all right, I'm taking you out. I'm taking you out. We're going to send Bill in. Right. There's so many. Yeah. But there are now, there is a brick and mortar romance novel store in Culver City, California, called The Ripped Bodice.
Excellent.
And there's one in LA, there's one in New York, to my knowledge. And it's almost just, it's, they've made a commitment to being this bookstore. And then people come in and they're like, yes, but where are, you know, the sports werewolf books? And you're like, okay, all right, there's, I know I have half a shelf of sports werewolf books. And yes. Right. And so I go in and I'm like, where's just regular Regency romance novels? I'll take Victorian. I'll take, cause I like, it's a, it is Georgette Heyer. I think we talked about her last time you were on.
Yeah.
That is where it all sort of, because her writing was consistent and very good. Like I even read her mystery novels.
She and was so good and so historically accurate. She doesn't use a word in a book that isn't like exactly to the day that it was first in public use. She's like genuinely a good writer, I would say, of the equivalent of like P.G. Woodhouse for light, delightful entertainment. Let's not at all mention the money-lending Jews. Let's just keep that aside.
Oh, my gosh.
There are a few of those.
There's a couple of those.
I read those books before I knew about that. I was Jewish. I didn't know it was a thing.
Right. And there's often some sort of in the earliest ones, the ones that were written in the 20s and 30s, there's genuine trouble writing. There's like servants that are black. And there's a couple of references to that where you just want to go, I'm going to need you to shut it.
Staple those pages together. It's fine.
Right. But if you get rid of them, if you whitewash them, then you never acknowledge that those things were done either. So you have to acknowledge that people are to this day are learning. Are you kidding me? The learning curve right now is incredibly steep as I'm trying to figure out gender and sexuality and I will say this. I was at a pharmacy and I picked up a romance novel because it had the good picture on the cover. And it was a set in Wellington, Waterloo, Napoleonic wartime.
Excellent.
And I read it and it was good, but it was, the romance novel was, it was a trans romance novel.
Is that K.J. Charles? Maybe.
Don't know the author, but I will tell you. And because it didn't do for me sexy times wise. Like it's not the softcore porn that I need. But
yes.
It's the softcore porn that I will make do with. And but it was a fascinating. I mean, I'm sure it's got to be awesome for someone to whom that there should be crap for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for a while there, the function we have shifted what art is meant to be to some degree. It used to be that, I mean, part of the fun for me was to imagine these idealized worlds, which included these like incredibly sexy women or incredibly powerful men and it wasn't about me seeing myself in the text.
Right.
And then, you know, after a while you're like, well, you know, as all art is a dialectic. You go, this is great, and this is argument against that. And then this one comes along and is like, but why aren't we doing more of this other thing? And then you get the thing that is my doctum that I wanted to talk about, which is these incredible subgenres that are coming up now, just in fantasy and romance. And all of the genres are now having these just forkings into miniature subgenres, right, with incredible depth niche and specificity.
Yeah. You're right.
Which is so much fun.
It's representation, I suppose, for everyone, so that we can all see ourselves in these different situations. But it's super niche, kind of like the internet itself.
It's so much a response, I think, to fan fiction. But like, for example, there's one genre that is called progression fantasy, right? And there are subgenres within progression fantasy, but let's just deal with progression fantasy. It is basically as though you were a game character. You get like stats and power boosts, and it is explicit in the text that you upgrade your character, and then the character moves through the world and engages with challenges and skills at their level.
What?
So like the games that were a response to fantasy novels have now got fantasy novels that are about what it would be like to be the person in the game.
Right. Oh my and God.
So there's one that's
essentially your D&D character or your Hero Instant character or your super like champions, like all of these tabletop role-playing games, pen and paper, where you have stats, where you have charisma, where you have strength, where you have intelligence, and you have and then you have weaknesses and drama traits and all these things. It's all written into the narrative?
It's all
narrative?
Written into the thing. So I would say the best place to start with that would be Dungeon Crawler Carl, which I think is very well written for people who are not necessarily gamers. But the world is destroyed. He survives and his cat survives and they go into the dungeon and then they, you know, you get a HUD up and you've got your stats there and you're like, oh, shit. And then the game tells you what your skills are and you've got to get a potion and, like, all of those things. All of those things are part of the novel.
What? That's so it's like choose your own adventure, but not because it's a novel. You're not choosing. You have essentially been dropped into this post-apocalyptic world or whatever. And Dungeon Crawler Carl?
Dungeon Crawler Carl, as in.
Okay. So Carl ends up in a dungeon and then he is aware of his own stats, essentially, in this.
Yes. And the cat also becomes sentient. And so he and the cat, and there's sort of that, there's a kind of a Hunger Games-y element where you have sponsors outside the games and it's sort of this intergalactic thing where the Earth has been colonized and then they're forced to fight. It's a whole subgenre. Like, it's incredible. Yeah.
Okay. What else? What else is happening in the? So that's called progression fantasy.
That's called progression fantasy, and there are like other subgenres within that. There's one that's like specifically related to like Korean gaming stuff. Portal fantasies within progression fantasy. There's that. That's one of the new ones. In romance, you have like just an extraordinary proliferation of these subgenres. Things like, have you heard about the Omegaverse?
No.
There was a recent lawsuit about the Omegaverse where people who were writing novels set in the Omegaverse, one of them sued the other because she said that she was the first one to write a novel set in the Omegaverse. But of course, the Omegaverse was invented by the fan fiction community and no one really owned the premise of it, which is, let me be clear, a deranged premise, but also lots of fun, which is that instead of two genres of people with
of humanity,
instead of two genders or three genders, you have men and women and alphas and betas and omegas. So that alphas sort of, you can be a female alpha, but you have the power to impregnate omegas.
They have
heat cycles, like the old like Kirk Spock fan fiction sex stuff where someone would go into heat. So it's sort of not your fault. It's got that kind of ravishment fantasy part of it.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
But then it also is a great place to play with ideas of gender, because you either have two men or a woman and a man, the woman's the alpha and she's impregnating the man. And what does it do to a man? What if you're assumed to be an alpha but you're actually an omega? What if you're an omega who's actually wants to be treated well? Like,
wow.
And this is a whole shared universe, and it's now gone again from the like deepest, darkest, like secret perverts of the internet into real books that you can hold in your hand, where
Yeah.
It's happening.
It's happening. It's because I think that, I mean, fan fiction itself just is, it just empowers every weird thought you've ever had. And, yes. And knowing that things are fiction is such an important part of reading anyway. Right. And yes. It's not, I mean, just to state the obvious, it's, you know, just because you are playing Star Wars doesn't mean yes. you're in Star Wars. You yes. have to go to work eventually, right? You have yes. to actually make dinner, and there won't be a droid to do it. So, but it also
yeah. doesn't mean you want to be, like, enjoying Star Wars doesn't mean you want to be in Star Wars. So this is, I think, one of the things that people get sort of upset about, particularly when it comes to, like, romance or fantasy or problematic books, the idea that entering the book space means you must approve of it or want it to be true, that or even that something that turns you on is something that you want to be true.
Right.
But, you know, that's not what it's the same kind of fallacy as the idea that, you know, people criticize romance novels for not being realistic. They're not meant to be realistic. They are vast operas that, like, use grand metaphors to draw in big strokes these very small, intimate dynamics that happen between people. They're not meant to be, you know, it's not meant to be realistic. You know, he's a billionaire who can't have feelings. And she has to, you know, talk him into giving up his big business to come and work on her kelp farm in the Outer Hebrides. And that's how he proves that he loves her.
Right. And nobody actually wants that, right? I mean,
no.
Or if you do, I mean, they're...
That's the opera version of, like, he just comes home and he's on his phone. I just want him to, like, actually have a conversation with me about the things I care about. But it's like, it's the
fantasy.
It's a different language. Yeah, it's the metaphor, right? You're using these metaphors to deal with the things. And so, you know, you don't necessarily want to see a world in which a young man can be forcibly impregnated by his science tutor, who's a sexy older lady with a salt and pepper hair. But you do want to think about, like, power dynamics and what does it mean to have a body that can be pregnant? What does that do to your status in society? You don't feel like you're less than because your body is capable of getting pregnant. So let's play out a scenario where that happens. And is that sexy or not sexy to think about that dynamic being turned? Like, all of those things, people are so literal. Like, I think he's not meant to be literal. This is like this fucking dream interpretation shit. Like, this is the two-headed snake means that you've got conflict in your toilet. Like, it's
you gotta go
with it, you know?
Yeah. This is such an excellent point, because I was raised to hide the romance novels because people are like, well, you're never going to find a boyfriend who's anything like any of these people. And I would try to explain that was not what I wanted.
Yes.
You know, I didn't want some pushy douche nozzle who was going to be mean to me so that I was going to like him. Like, it was just, which is partially why when some of the dudes would read the books and they'd be like, oh, this is what women want. Yes. And then negging was invented. And you're like, no one wanted that. We were showing you something else. It was,
It was something, it's something different. And I mean, the joy of a good romance novel is that it's like a detective novel. You are set up in the first chapter. You've got the recipe, right? This is the hero. This is the heroine. These are his issues. These are the ways in which he represents the toxic masculinity. I'm talking about, obviously, the kind of trad, cishet kind of romances. Yes. And they have this irresistible sexual attraction that creates the lockbox. Yeah. They are drawn to each other. They can't resist one another. That's not the fantasy. The fantasy is not that someone can't resist you. The fantasy is that they'll stick around and figure it out with you. And the mechanism by which they are forced to stick it out and figure it out with you is this irresistible sexual attraction. They put you in the lockbox.
It's this arbitrary thing where you end up, for in a lot of the older romance novels, they're forced to get married because she's been compromised, or he needs money, or some lockbox fabrication that you don't actually want to still exist. Like, I don't want to be sold as chattel and then had to figure out how we love each other. But the how we love each other, how we find out how we love each other, is why I read the book.
Yes. And so it lets them play it out in these large strokes. So instead of like, oh, you know, he comes home and he's only interested in talking about work, she gets kidnapped by highwaymen and he has to fucking find her and just prove that he has paid attention to the color of her dress so he knows how to find her. These are all sort of
any small, just, it's just a please treat me as a human being at the very end of it. There was one that I, you know how like you keep, like, I keep science fiction novels to reread, obviously. I keep a lot of books to reread, and they're mostly not Shakespeare. Let's just say that, right? It's they're Spencer for Hire novels, right? Mm-mm. They're mysteries, or they're romances, or they're science fiction, or they're a variety of different genre novels that I reread, and I reread them because there's real human moments in them. There's a romance writer named Mary Ballow. And
yes, I love Mary Ballow. Yes, she's amazing.
I cry. And I don't cry in real life very often. More now, just because I think it's just hormones and the aging process. But like literally like emotional crying of, oh, someone was mean to her. Or he didn't get it. Like literally just the misunderstanding trope, right? I was just like,
they dial it up to 11. So it has this like incredible emotive power. And then they solve this puzzle that they've set. It's so satisfying because if it's done well, it's also, you get to a point at 3/4 through a romance novel with a fucking Fabio on the front and you go, it cannot possibly work out. And then it does. A good writer will take you there despite the fact that you've picked it up knowing it will work out. That's the job of the book. And it's still, if they do it right, you go, oh my goodness, how can they ever work? And then they do.
Yes.
It's a fucking magic trick where they've showed you all the cards and that there's nothing up their sleeves and they still pull it off. What an extraordinary.
Yes. Exactly. And there was one, and I cannot remember the name of the author, but it was this one about like there had been a misunderstanding, like he hates, it's 1847 or 67 or 897. It doesn't even matter, but she's Irish. And she had moved to America and she comes back to look for her brothers because they were Protestant, but they had all been, half of them had been, she thought they had all been killed, but it turns out a couple of them had been sent to Australia. And she had been sent to America as a indentured servant. And so she ends up, her employer puts up her contract in a card game, and the guy who's our hero hates the Irish because his dad was killed by him in a very famous battle, but he can't, obviously he can't tolerate someone just buying another person, and so he buys her, and then he's like, and then right, and
to stop anyone worse, like, buying her, he buys her first.
Classic. And then,
love a card
and then
game. Yep,
love a card game. Card game trope, that's out there. And then he's like, yeah, you can do whatever you want. You don't have to stay or go. And she's like, I'm gonna work it off. And then and then they essentially heal from socio-political differences, race and religion differences, all of these things are very real issues in real life that are brought about by a card game and an absurdity that, it's so great. Anyway.
And you get to talk about these things in the context of like lightness and knowing that it's going to be all right. And so you actually get to kind of touch on things that are in a way that isn't exhausting.
That it isn't an Oprah slice of life book. An Oprah slice of life book is something that I've almost never wanted to read. just because it's so sad sack. And I don't know that it's going to end up okay. I need to know that it's going to end up okay. In real life, I don't know if anything's going to end up okay. When I get into a book, when I watch a movie, I need to know it's going to be okay. It is what I enjoy. So it's not that I'm unwilling to face real life. It just means that when I'm in entertainment mode, I want the good guys to win and I want love to prevail. Yeah.
This is the thing. Like, that is also, and this is what all these books and all these subgenres and all these like slightly derided art forms like make me want to talk about. And I chose romance novels for the book that I was writing because I think it's sort of the biggest victim of that. But it's okay. You don't need to legitimize something. It's okay. It's enough that it's just brings you joy. Like it.
Yeah. Yeah.
No one asks, you know, if someone's like, oh, I'm into sports. No one's like, well, is that a serious pursuit?
Like, you're right. You don't have to explain to me that you enjoy the fact that these are the best, you know, these guys work out so hard that they can catch a ball and throw a ball and run real fast. And
actually sports is war by other means. And we really need to like consider the fact that we're, you know, being able to sublimate our cultural aggression into like, just no, it's nice. It's fun. It's good. It's a thing you want to do, man.
Right. Like, right. I love watching X Games because it looks like a video game, but it's real. Neat. Yeah. Congratulations. You can make your bike go up into the sky and then do a flip and then land on it and not die. That's all I needed.
and yet somehow because the thing that the people to whom it is giving joy are, at least in the public imagination, middle-aged housewives trying to make themselves happy. Ugh, how pathetic. Yeah. You know, like what?
Yes. That is
why,
it.
How
that
dare
is
they it. Try to make themselves happy? Like, what do you mean? Is it more pathetic than a guy going doing a fantasy football league with his mates?
Right. Jimmy Pardo calls fantasy baseball fantasy accounting, and because it's just spreadsheets, much like polygamy, There's the joy for joy. I love that. I love that. You know, there's no need to justify your joy.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong. I will absolutely justify it up to the armholes. I am fascinated by the ways in which it like reflects and shapes cultural dynamics in which like, for example, like the progression fantasy or the romanticy surge and all of these things like are changing the genres and who those books are for and all of that stuff. I'm happy to talk about that with my like nerd glasses pushed right up the bridge of my nose. But also, at the end of the day, it is enough that they are joyful. They are about joy. Like, mm-hmm. the outcome mm-hmm. is joyful. You know you're not going to end up with a woman in a fucking fridge or, like, miserable proving something to the horrible college professor that knocked her up. Like, you just
– yeah.
It's going to be fine.
But it's – right. It's harder for me – nobody ever has to justify their love of true crime, you know? But they do. No. They do justify it saying,
"That's not my egg. I'm sorry."
It is right. No, it's not for me either, but I know people who love it but some people love it because it gives them it's sort of like a love of horror. It's somehow cathartic.
Yes.
And the fact that they're like, "This gets all of me being scared out in the open." And then true crime that's solved is gives that sort of same thing that romance novels and science space opera and all of these things.
The arc of time bends towards justice or that things will be solved in the end.
Yeah. So, oh, by the way, it has been almost an hour. And I just have to say that we've been nonstop talking with Alice Frazier. Right. This has been the greatest. So, but it's at Alliterative and it'll be in the notes. And her Patreon is Alice Frazier and it's alicefrazier.com. Blue Sky, it's Alice Frazier. But on like Instagram, it's Alliterative. So, and your book is A Passion for Passion.
A Passion for Passion. Yeah, you can buy it online now. And it's very exciting. But like, this is also kind of, I guess I'll wrap up on this, which is I'm a big old nerd. I was the library, you know, roving library monitor in school. I've been being told since I was 16 that I should write a book. And I have never been able to write a book because I've always been intimidated by the idea, but what if it's not good?
Mm.
And I wrote this book incredibly quickly because they asked me to and because it was silly. And the fact that it was silly let me do it. I got out of my own way.
Yeah.
And I run these writers' meetings on my Patreon, and so many people who I talk to have these brilliant ideas, and they talk themselves out of them because they take them too seriously.
Right.
And so, like, I feel like maybe my life manifesto is to do silly, fun things, that there is just immense value in lowering the stakes a little bit.
Right, right. As Miles Vorkosigan says, lower the wall, you know? Don't make the wall, just make it easier for people to go, okay.
Yeah.
I can do this. And that's awesome that to write a book that by your own admission is silly.
Yeah.
That it just, it means it can be as good or bad as anybody wants to read it. And you enjoyed writing it?
I loved writing it. It was so much fun.
That's amazing. So, because I have always wanted to have written a book. I don't want to write a book because it sounds like a lot of work. And
try writing something really silly. Turns out it's quite easy.
Just write something and then it'll be a book and then it'll be absurd and you will have written it. And okay, I love the idea of that. That's amazing. How long is it? How big is the book?
My goodness, I don't know. I haven't. I've got
it. It's readable. Hasn't, right? It's because you know how, like, in the romance novels when I and in science fiction when I first started reading them, they were all 180 pages published in mass paperback size, and then they became 220.
Yeah.
And now Brandon Sanderson cannot finish a book that isn't 680 pages, and you're like, nobody wanted that.
No.
Stop doing. Even N.K. Jemisin, who builds these amazing worlds, these science fiction, they're too long. Chop, chop. I get it. Write 13. Do Terry Pratchett. Write 30 of them where you're on the back of a turtle, and they're all 180 to 220 pages, and I'll buy every single one of them.
I will buy every single one of them, and six of them are the same book in different hats, and I don't care.
I don't care.
I want that book. Give it to me six times.
Right. From a vaguely different angle. Just do this. This is great. Yep. I'm in. I'm on
board. Give me the whole fucking Discworld. Turtles all the way down.
It took me probably five or six of those books, and I could do five or six because they were 180 pages. Because I was like, people love Terry Pratchett. Cage Baker's, one of her favorite authors was Terry Pratchett. It was the episode of The Dork Forest that I talked to Cage Baker. She said that the only thing she could read right now was Terry Pratchett and Shakespeare. Yeah. And I was like, wow. All right. So which made me read Terry Pratchett. And so I was like, oh, it's kind of dumb. Oh, it's kind of dumb. Oh, it's kind of dumb, but fun. Oh, it's really dumb, but fun. Oh, it's just fun. And that was the progression of that. And then I've read probably 15 out of what, 30. And they're great.
They're great. And they're so much fun. And then he sneaks these little like fucking daggers of satire in that are just so on the point. And then you find that the next time you're trying to explain a complex situation, you're like, so Sam Vimes has this theory of economics that's based on cheap boots, and it just infiltrates your mind.
Yes, it does. That is the greatest thing about this. It's revolutionary to some extent. It's not invidious, but it's like, it's a great way because they do create, I will say this, Lois McMaster Bujold, more than once I say things like, if you want different consequences, you have to do different actions. And that is what is in Shards of Honor in Beriar, you know?
Well, you know, that whole kind of Vorkosigan saga, although it's in theory mostly about Miles, the underlying what-if sci-fi, hard sci-fi element is mostly the uterine replicators, right?
Yep, yes.
And it's how different societies deal with that technology, the idea of taking the process of making and having a baby out of the female body. What does that do? Whether you have like Ethan of Athos, where you've got the whole planet full of men, and what does that do to, or whether you have the various, you know, the
beta colony where they can, they control the reproduction from childhood with implants and all this stuff. And then how does she explain it? She says, you know, on beta colony, they have uterine replicators. On Beriar, they've had to control the entire person. Yeah. And that's why women don't have any rights, is because they have had to control the entire human. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And that, I mean, that's sort of the underlying, you know, that's the drumbeat underneath all of the space opera part, is the like the what if speculative kind of science of it is actually that. And that's one of the things I love so much about it.
Right. And I wish scientists would invent a replicant though in one of the later books,
they have, and they've done a laminate already.
Oh, have they? Oh, they have done a laminate. That's true. But I will say that in one of the later Vorkosigan books, though, that guy who buys like 50 uterine replicators and then makes like 50 babies. Yes.
And then Cordelia solves the problem by making him pay their dowries, right?
It was Ekaterin, I believe. It was Ekaterin and Miles together came up with the idea that he's got to provide dowries for all of them. And
such a good
Oh my gosh. I could talk to you for another 30 hours. But I'm gonna call it, just because this has been so great. I need to get a cup of coffee. But I like you. Let us hang out in real life one day. And everybody, Alice Fraser, Fraser, and it's A Passion for Passion is the book, and it's at Alliterative or on Blue Sky, Alice Fraser, alicefraser.com. It'll be in the notes. And thank you so much for doing
thank
this.
You.
I have had such a good time.
I'm so happy and excited. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. And I'm very pleased.
Gotta go to bed. All right. And Rangers, you know the rules out there. Take care of each other.
Hi, Adal. How was the show?
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Well, it was actually really fun. She has been on one other time.
Yeah.
Alice Fraser. I can't, couldn't tell you what year, couldn't tell you what episode, but this time she's episode 805. 805 of the pre-recorded. There's still another 217 of the held up to a microphone craziness.
Oh, really?
Yes. But she talked about essentially, I was thinking about what to call it, and it's sort of disrespected genres.
Oh.
And
in literature or?
In literature.
Oh, okay.
And
like just, poetry.
No. Though I would enjoy if you would do that.
Oh,
would
I don't
you
know.
Do you
want to
do an episode on poetry?
I don't think I can. I don't think I have the chops. I don't think I am severely underdressed for poetry.
It's
I don't think I respect
more
mainstream. Poetry enough.
Do you respect fan fiction?
No, actually I don't.
So there you go. And so
actually I kind of do though. I kind
you
of
should.
Do. I should.
Should. Just because all it is it's you know,
it's people writing about the thing that they love writing about, and expanding on universes that they love. So yes, I do actually respect fanfic.
Yes, and they're practicing writing. And so when they do end up,
if they want to create worlds, they may never want to create their own worlds. They may be perfectly happy.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Just writing in somebody else's
Nicole
world.
Nicole Levy wrote fan fiction for decades.
Oh right,
and now
she executive produces television shows.
Right. She got into like a writing thing at Warner Brothers,
because that was what she wanted to do. But I'm just saying that there's a lot of people in fanfic who don't.
Right.
They don't care about doing any of that. They're not interested in turning their.
Right. But so Alice Fraser has written a book called A Passion for Passion. And it's sort of about romance novels, though. We did talk a lot about science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about fantasy and how the credibility of that has been made as, yeah, you know, as it's going.
It's sort of weird, right? Because they were like literary, not getting the respect, but of course there was a lot of people buying it.
Right. Right. And so I remember when I took the Lord of the Rings, I told her this, is the Lord of the Rings class in 1985 or 84. Right.
That was,
and it was
that
the
was
first
the,
one.
That was deep in the heart of science fiction, not getting any sort of respect.
Right. It was just starting to get
I think it's getting a lot more respect now than it was then.
For sure. For sure. And it's happening with fantasy novels, obviously, you know, when stuff gets turned into movies and TV shows and the money is a little more public.
Right.
Yeah. So, but it was a fascinating episode and she was great.
That's awesome. So that sounds great.
Yeah.
It sounds right down my alley.
It was a wide, shallow pool of information. It was pretty great. I recommend everyone listen to it. And Rangers, you know, the rules out there, same for 2025. Take care of each other out there.
My hat, my hat, my hat. They're dancing around my hat. My hat, my hat, my hat. Well, what do you think of that? If it looks like a Mexican hat dance and it sounds like a Mexican hat dance, it's most likely a Mexican hat dance. So take off your hat and let's dance.
Yay! Oh, my God. Why don't we just call that as the end of the show?